Okay, I'm going to encourage you to comments, interact, because we're going to continue where we were last week. And we got a little over half, I think, last time. So we're a little less than half this time. So please feel free. So we are looking at the fifth commandment under the Westminster Larger Catechism. I did attempt to go through all 11 questions at once. Not surprisingly, that did not happen. But really, I think it was a good thing because that means there was interaction, comments, questions going on. And I always appreciate that. Now, if you remember, the first question that we actually looked at was a transition question where we went from the commandments that have a vertical orientation to God to those commandments that have a horizontal orientation to our fellow man. And of course, as we said many, many times, even though we say they're horizontal, the reason why we are obliged to keep them is because it's still vertical. God has levied this upon us, right? Then we started looking at the 10 questions concerning the command to honor your father and your mother. Now, when we compare that to the other commandments, 10 questions seems like a lot. But what we saw last time is that the catechism does a very similar thing to what the Apostle Paul does in Ephesians. And we looked at that last time. Remember, Paul starts by quoting this command of the responsibility of children to their parents. But then he immediately turns it around to say that the father is to treat the child a certain way, right? Not to antagonize them. And then move from there from slaves are to behave to their masters, and then how masters are to treat their slaves, which probably we would put in an orientation today, mostly as far as employees and employers. And so that expansion of that hierarchy and our interrelationships within that hierarchy of authority is the context that the Westminster divines adopted when they wrote this. And so, for example, it asks the reader, it says, who is meant when the commandment says father and mother? And the answer is, yes, it's your natural parents. Of course it's your natural parents. But it's also anyone who is superior to us in age, authority, especially in the family, in the church, and in the commonwealth or society. And so we see that primary reference. Yes, it's to parents. And the reason for that is because the family is the most fundamental unit of human society. It's not the state. It's the family. And the relationships between child and parent in a very profound way is really what shapes the world. As God himself says, if that relationship conforms to his instruction, remember it has a promise attached to it. And so there will be peace, there'll be order, there'll be prosperity in the land. But when we raise our children to esteem themselves above all others, should we be surprised by a generation that worships self? We shouldn't. That's the way we've raised them. And if children learn to have no respect for the authority of parents, they learn to disrespect all authority. And that's the context that's in these questions. And so as the catechism refers to superiors and inferiors, which again today would be a trigger word, you'd have people upset at this, trying to find a safe place. You couldn't say superior and inferior. All it's saying is that there are structures in society. I have people that work for me as a manager, but I have other managers that I answer to. That's a structure. That's a hierarchy. Today we're trying to throw out all hierarchies. That's going to lead to anarchy. It has to. And it says that those who have authority are as fathers and mothers, and that they have a responsibility to work with those who are beneath them, like a parent to a child, in kindness and encouragement as they are performing their duties. And as we said last time, God has ordered the world, and it's really by grace, to have a structure. Because a world, as I said, without order, without a hierarchy, is anarchy. To deny authority is really to deny providence, especially in the three divine institutions that exist in the world, the family, the church, and the state. And so the catechism works through the several relationships within the hierarchy, In other words, as question 126 says, how we relate to inferiors, superiors, and as equals. So we work through some of these, starting with question 127, which asks what we owe to those who are superior to us in authority. And I shouldn't have to say it, but I will. Again, it has nothing to do with your inherent worth. When the catechism is talking about superiors and inferiors, it's not talking about you as a person, your worth as a person. It's simply in the role that you have in the structure. And we should not be upset at that, because that's the same thing that God the Son has done. Ontologically, in their being, Father, Son, and Spirit are all equal. And yet the Son, in what we call the economic Trinity, has chosen and has agreed to be under the authority of the Father. If it's good enough for the Son of God, it ought to be good enough for us. In any case, the answer says we should owe a proper reverence or respect in what we do and what we say, and we should pray for them. We should imitate their virtues and graces. We should be obedient to their direction when it is lawful. And we should submit to their correction and humility. I have a lot of young engineers coming up, and I tell you what, in the engineering fields, they are so sharp. They are so sharp. But what they don't have is experience. And you can kind of tell, I've got some who come in knowing they're sharp and have a hard time listening. And then others who come in, they also know they're sharp, but they respect the experience and they're open to learning. I can tell you which is the better employee and the better relationship. All right. So you can see in this that not only the application to children being raised by their parents, but to our elders in general. And so it also applies to those who have earned positions of authority in the church, in the workplace, and in the state. And we should obey until it conflicts with the command of God. And what we said was that we are duty-bound to submit to laws that are enacted by men, as we are obligated to submit to the laws of God. But when the two come into conflict, obviously God's law supersedes. And in our day, there's beginning an increase in conflict, isn't there? Now, the flip side, then, of what we owe to them is, well, then, what are the sins we might commit against those who are over us? And the answer is, of course, when we neglect our responsibilities. That's number one. And when we are envious or contemptuous of those who are above us, so that we rebel or we begrudge their instruction or their correction. And it says things like cursing and mocking, and then we like this phrase we looked at last time, all such refractory and scandalous carriage, which we went and I had to look that up. What does that mean? And it simply means what every teenager goes through, a headstrong, rebellious attitude or posture. And what we noted was human behavior goes through stages. Remember, where is the greatest narcissism expressed? It's in infancy. Parents have to dampen that narcissism. And then they usually get a breather between the terrible twos and the terrible teens. But the point being that a child must be trained when they are impressionable. Why does the state want your children when they're young and impressionable? Right? Hitler actually said that, right? He wanted to get his hands on the children to begin to train them in his ideology. It's our responsibility to train them up in the ways of the Lord and to curb self. If we don't, then the self that is within will continue its open rebellion against authority, because in the end, it's a rebellion against the ultimate authority, which is God. But just as Paul started with children and then admonished fathers, the catechism goes from what we owe our superiors to what is required from those superiors concerning those beneath them? And the answer is that because that authority is given by God, we owe those beneath us an attitude of love, or we might say goodwill. We also owe them prayers and blessings, so that we instruct and we counsel them because we should want them to succeed. I shouldn't have that attitude with my young engineers coming in. I know you're smarter than I am, so I need to put you down because I need to be at the top. That's a terrible attitude. We should want them to succeed. We should be free to commend them when they do good, and we should not be afraid to chastise them when they do wrong, but do it in the right attitude. And we should protect them. We should provide for them. And by our wisdom and godly example, it says we bring glory to God and we preserve that authority that he has given us. Or it may be lost. There's a saying, you know, that respect is earned. You have a position of authority. It comes with a certain amount of respect in and of itself. But by your attitude, you can lose that respect. So the principle here is that with any authority, there also comes responsibility. And the greater the authority, the greater the responsibility. As we said, if you are in authority, it is God who has placed you there. And ultimately, you are responsible to God for exercising that authority rightly. And that's where we ended last time. And it's not just that parents have a responsibility to protect their children from a corrupt world, you know, from the harmful, ungodly influences there. Elders in the church, or employers, or state officials have a responsibility to provide guidance and protection as regards to each in their related spheres. It is an absolute duty for the elders of a church to protect her members from false teachers, from hurtful behavior, from poor doctrine. It is the responsibility of the elders to take that seriously. It is also a duty for managers on the job to protect the health and the well-being of those who work beneath them and to discharge their obligation to the company, but in a way that doesn't misuse or abuse their fellow human beings. And the state has the responsibility to create and to enact and enforce laws that embody justice. When we look at Paul's discourse in Romans chapter 13, the Apostle Paul said that governments are authorized by God to be a terror to bad conduct, not to the good. He says that the one in authority is God's agent against who? The wrongdoer. But when a government punishes good and promotes the wicked, Romans 13 is no longer descriptive of true government. Now, it remains true that a wicked government is still in place by God, but it's there in judgment, just as God told Pharaoh, "I raised you up just to show my power in bringing you down." But the bottom line is that God's people cannot submit to ungodliness, much less institutional ungodliness. And by the way, the function of the state is not properly to provide for the family except under dire emergencies. It is the function of the state to maintain social order, economic order, so that her citizens can provide for their own families. That's the role of government. And we're beginning to see, I would say, a collapse, a judgment, as God has removed the restraints. We have always been a rebellious people. We worship at the altar of, you know, independence and individualism. But God appears to be loosening those restraints as we move towards chaos. I remember, it's a famous person, I don't remember his name, but he was a Frenchman who came over early on in the country's existence, and you know, basically was being asked, you know, well, what do you think about what's going on in the Americas? And he says, well, it's fascinating. He said, but when they realize that they can vote themselves money, it'll collapse. Well, now we've found out we can vote away the police force. You know what I'm saying? We're voting in chaos. We're voting in ungodliness. And that's why you'll see persecution in the church. And you notice that the answer closes with that it's by carrying their offices with grace, wise and holy attitude, again, that there is honor to God. And you bring honor to yourself. And that's how they preserve the authority they've been given. When our state officials, when they govern in a way that brings glory to God, they bring honor to themselves. And they retain respect. But for those in authority who abuse that authority, or who are disreputable, or who provide examples that are dishonorable, the result is a contempt for their authority. And in essence, then, they lose it. We've seen this over and over again. The preacher who is found in gross sin, or the state official who breaks the law, or who governs corruptly, the casualty is their reputation. And with reputation, you have the loss of respect. And with the loss of respect, you have the loss of authority. The father who lives like the devil can't expect his children to learn to be reverent. The employer who treats his employees like chattel can only expect the efforts given by chattel. Okay. Question 130. So what are the sins of superiors? Long list, actually. It says the sins of superiors are, besides the neglect of the duties required of them, an inordinate seeking of themselves and their own glory, ease, profit, or pleasure, commanding things unlawful, or not in the power of inferiors to perform, counseling, encouraging, or favoring them in that which is evil, dissuading, discouraging, or discountenancing them in that which is good, correcting them unduly, careless, exposing, or leaving them to wrong, temptation, and danger, provoking them to wrath, or in any way dishonoring themselves or lessening their authority by an unjust, indiscreet, rigorous, or remiss behavior. Wouldn't it be wonderful if everyone in authority lived under that? Remembered that. That starts with the neglect of their duties. That's a sin that the catechism assumes is almost self-evident. If you've been given a job to do and you're not doing that job, you're stealing money. That's theft. But then it adds to it that when there's a wrong heart or a wrong attitude, when you're selfish and greedy, it almost always results in exploitation. Putting your own career, for example, over the detriment of others is a sinful self-centeredness. And so are all immoral or predatory practices that are often defined as being, well, that's just business. What it really reminds me of, and we did this when we did church history, there's a good example to us of the differences in capitalism. You had John Calvin's Geneva, and you had the city-states of Genoa going on at the same time. The city-states of Genoa remind me of today. Very predatory, ruthless, all about accumulating wealth. Even to the point where the Genoa city-states told the crusaders, well, before you go fight Islam, I want you to go sack our Christian neighbors in Constantinople. And they did. ruthless. Whereas Calvin said the reason why capitalism works is that you do it for the betterment of your neighbors and society in general. When you lose that, when you're not governed, when capitalism stops being governed by those kinds of principles, it becomes greed. Even to the point, I've told this story before, the reason why the Swiss are known for being clockmakers is because prior to that, they were known for making jewelry. But all the fine ladies were coming in all decked out in their jewelry, and you had people, you know, almost on the level of poverty also coming into the church service, and Calvin just would point that out. And just message using the word of God, eventually those fine ladies said, you know, I'm going to stop wearing my jewelry. And so those jewelers couldn't make a living that way. So they took, you know, they're used to working with their hands. They turned to making clocks and watches. That's why they're known for that today. But it's just esteeming others over yourself. And so the answer says we sin against those in our care when we encourage them to evil or discouraging them against what is good. That's a perverse influence. You end up sharing in the responsibility of the evil they eventually do. If you encourage your child to be unruly and self-centered and, you know, you got to get yours or whatever, you share in the responsibility of the crimes that they would go and commit. You know, it is often unjust to blame the parents for the sins of a child, but if you're teaching them by example or encouraging that sin, yes, it's true. You should get blamed for those sins. God will not hold you guiltless for that. The same is true of a teacher who fosters a spirit of greed by a doctrine of divine wealth, or a state that protects perversity, punishes morality in her citizens. And the answer closes with a guard against provoking those in your charge to wrath, which is what Paul was referring to with fathers. You know, don't bring your children to exasperation. It's not that you can prevent them from wrath. In many cases, to stand for what is right may make their anger inevitable and yet necessary. What the catechism means is that we don't provoke them to anger by what is unreasonable or by what is unduly harsh or critical. For example, extreme strictness concerning trivial matters is more about power than it is correction. Or as Voss says, expecting children to perform a task as perfectly as an adult. They're not adults. Jason? Well, I think what you're seeing in that is that we're tied together. Those who rule and those who are ruled are tied together. So, for example, like you said, David calls for a census. Who suffers? The people. In the same way, the laws that ungodly laws that get enacted in our country, who bears the brunt of that? When you defund the police, for example, who bears the brunt of that? Not the politician who's behind a gated community. It's the people in their neighborhoods, right? Where crime and lawlessness and anarchy, they're the ones paying the price. That's exactly what they're talking about here, is a sin of a superior over the inferiors. And again, talking about positions of authority. Because they deserved it, yeah.
Because they deserved it. So nobody was guiltless in that situation.
No. And we're not guiltless either. We talk about, these immoral politicians. Well, we've been saying, how long have we been saying? Almost as long as I've been alive, we've been saying, God ought to judge this nation. Well, it's here. Yes.
And, Colossians is playing in the third chapter there, actually the last verse in that chapter, third chapter there, that he treats us all the same, regardless of our position.
Right. Yes. That's right. Exactly right. Jason?
Yeah, and one of the defining features, especially of modern day politicians around the world, and what differentiates them from not just the biblical society, but even just ancient societies, is that the rulers understood that they also were ruled by higher authority.
By a higher authority. Yeah, that's a minority now.
Or from the God that exists. But the way that modern politics work is that politicians don't seem to recognize that there is a step above them.
That is correct. That is correct. So there is no restraint. And so it's a motivation of self. It's all about power. That's what we're seeing. That you can call it all kinds of things, and it's disguised a lot of things. As far as social and there is social injustice, absolutely, but it's about power.
Everybody did what was right in their own.
That is correct. But it reminds me, it's no different in 1917 when, in the name of the serf, the oppressed class, you had the rise of communism. That was all about power. Mm-hmm. That was all about power. The people who suffered in that were the very same serfs who died in millions in their name. I'm here, we're bringing this workers' utopia to you, and by the way, you're going to die. So how's that for a utopia? That's where we're at. Exactly right. If there's, as Dostoevsky says, right? If there is no God, all things are permitted. So there is no restraint. And what a dangerous, precarious position it is in an age where you have media manipulation to maintain power, in which you can convince people to vote in their own enslavement. Anyway, We're on topic, but different soapbox probably. All right. So anyway, so in these kinds of sins of the superior, these kind of tendencies, these behaviors end up dishonoring, basically, if we're in authority, ourselves before the eyes of those who should be looking up to us as godly examples. And the result, it says in the answer, is a loss of authority because of, quote, unjust, indiscreet, rigorous, or remiss behavior. I have an example, Jason, from the Old Testament. 1 Samuel, man named Nabal, very wealthy, had a large family, but was, and I think I have this in there, I've lost my, yeah, there we go. This is a quote from the text. He had a reputation amongst his servants and even his wife of being such a son of Belial that a man cannot speak to him. So basically what it's saying, he was so rude and arrogant that his own family had no respect for him. The term son of Belial literally meant without yoke, someone who has no restraint. And so the ancient usage actually could mean worthless. So this man had all this money and all this power, but by his behavior, his own family said, this guy's worthless. So he was dishonored even amongst his household staff. He had wealth, but he had no worth in the eyes of others. Next question, what are the duties of equals? It says the duties of equals are to regard the dignity and worth of each other in giving honor to go one before another and to rejoice in each other's gifts and advancement as their own. Again, anytime we're talking about superiors or inferiors or equals, again, it has nothing to do with their inherent nature, only position of office. All humans are equal in nature. But there are many strata of offices and authority. And so Voss says, in human society, it is inevitable that some persons be unequal in authority. This inequality of position is God's ordinance. So this dream of equality of outcomes is not only unattainable, it always ends in tyranny. But what the Catechism means by equals are those on the same level of authority. And there are obligations owed by each to the other as well. Primarily, it is to recognize and respect the dignity of the other. For example, as a parent, I have a general respect of other parents to raise their children as they see fit, not as I see fit. I don't call for a child to be taken from a home because I disagree with their political views. That would be a sin. And yet, the same cannot be true of their attitudes towards me. The Catechism also says that we are to rejoice in each other's betterment as if it were our own. That means to guard against the sin of envy. And then speaking of sins, question 132, what are the sins of equals? And it says the sins of equals are, besides the neglect of the duties required, the undervaluing of the worth, envying the gifts, grieving at the advancement or prosperity one of another, and usurping preeminence one over another. You see this in the workplace all the time. One person gets acknowledgement or a promotion or whatever. Oh, that should have been mine. So we see where we left off. The sin of envy, selfishness, pride tends to magnify our own attainments, diminish those of others. Jason? Yeah.
And so what you end up with is a city that whenever visitors come in, the
Yeah, it's true.
And actually, I mean, not just, it brings to mind not just an equals, but if you look at the Old Testament, God continuously, over and over, is talking about the plight of the poor. Now, it wasn't the place, I don't believe it's the place of the state. Again, we said, it's not for them, except in dire emergency, you know, it's not for them to elevate their economic status. It's to provide an environment where the families of those people could do that. So you see that Scripture talks about orphans and widows, yes. Okay? But part of the problem we see, we talked about Christ talking about last time, where the Pharisees were not treating their parents properly, leaving them to go hungry by saying, yeah, I know I'm supposed to take care of them in their old age, but you know, I've dedicated all my money to God. Therefore, I'm not going to give it to them because that would be a sin. No, you're using that to get around your responsibility. So when we talk about sins against our equals, again, we have that selfishness. We can be envious, that pride. We look at what somebody does and we want to diminish that so that we look better. That can lead to bitterness. It can be resentful. And so the effects of that sin become the punishment of that sin. In other words, it eats away at the soul like acid. So you become miserable because somebody else has prospered. Or worse, you find some way of grasping for authority or prosperity that's not rightly yours. To be arrogant or domineering. To have the last word. To dictate to others when there's no right to do so. Peter warns, I think that's there, yeah. But let none of you suffer as a busybody in other men's matters. Ooh, we got to put that on a sign somewhere today. What the Greek actually says is, don't try to be an overseer, have authority over other people's affairs. And then finally, question 133, what is the reason annexed to the fifth commandment, the more to enforce it? And we've seen this kind of question before, where God adds something in the commandment. It's an additional thing that to emphasize that point. And so it says, the reason attached or annexed to the fifth commandment in these words, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God gives you, is an express promise of long life and prosperity as far as it will serve for God's glory and their own good to all such as keep this commandment. Now I want you to note the qualification and the answer. Long life and prosperity is given as far as it shall serve God's glory. So you can't take this and put it in your promise box and demand a long life and prosperity, mostly because you're not capable of keeping the commandment anyway. But what is really being given here is an effect upon society that practices obedience to the fifth commandment. We said this before, in a society that respects authority. And then that legitimate authority fulfills its responsibilities to those who are in their care. What's the result of that? In general, well, those conditions make for peace and order, benevolence, that in turn generally enhances prosperity and long lives. That's what's being said here. On the other hand, disrespect for legitimate authority or an abuse of authority or the promotion of a godless authority leads to anarchy, leads to chaos, it leads to oppression. Those kinds of things tend to curtail prosperity and shorten lives. So it's a cause and effect. But it's a cause and effect that is ordained by God because he is the one who has ordered it this way. When we looked at the fifth commandment in the Heidelberg, we said that the larger context is that when we teach our children respect and honor for their parents, We are training them to have respect and honor for the wider community. And that respect of authority and the authority itself is God's providential means of preserving a fallen humanity, to restrain their spiritual insanity, this intense self-centeredness. Anarchy unleashes that insanity. And it also becomes a just punishment for itself. So honor your father and your mother, and your children will likely do the same. That's at the heart of the promise. It's a legacy that preserves families, preserves cultures, preserves societies. But in the words of Philip Schaff, the generation that tramples on a past generation can expect no regard from its posterity. That's what's being bred today. When there is no respect for what has gone on before, what you're doing is sowing the seeds that the generation that follows will have no respect for you. And that's where we are today. Today we have fostered a belief in our children that reviles authority, reviles hierarchies, so that protesting, regardless of cause, is now seen as a moral and civic good, even in and of itself. But what we should remember is that order is easy to break, very difficult to restore.